interest rate is X, because except instead of mapping, let's say, from 40 to 100, they map from 75 to 99, right? But if you got 60 in this guess, you did quite good. That is the average. That probably gets you a D, something in that range, right? And then something about 70, you're starting looking at A minus, right? So this is not a promise. This is just an estimate, right? Just to calibrate yourself on what happened. So for this midterm, actually, the average was a little bit lower than it should be. That said, some people still did really well, so the highest grade is actually 90%. There was demonstrably a slight problem with question 3A, and I think it confused some people a little bit. And if I'm totally fair, like, I don't think it's entirely only my fault, because I've used the question before and people were not confused, but I can understand how people can be confused. So as such, I'm going to count the midterm only about part of 55 instead of part of 60. Okay? So that adjusts the average of the midterm to 60%. So we have good, acceptable performance. And I'll explain what the problem was with question 3A later. Right? And it's just like, I think it's just an English thing, where I was expecting a certain thing, and some people thought I expected more. And again, spent some extra time trying to do it. Most people tried to do it, but didn't really take a long time to do it. So it was like maybe wasting a couple of minutes on it and then giving up. But that still means you probably lost 5 or so minutes trying to do it. And so hence I'm going to reduce 5 grades. So we will also post everybody's grades on Canvas. Okay, so people who are not here can see this. But just remember that we are marking it out of 55. So just a reminder on then the actual way the course grade works. So the problem set 1 is 10%, the second problem set is 10%, and then the midterm is 20, and then your exam is 60. Right? So the good news is that the average for the problem set is very high. Right? Way too high, way above the average, right? So if your midterm grade is not that great, maybe something happens, that doesn't mean your final grade will be bad, because you probably did okay in your problem set 1. You can still concentrate and do really well in your problem set 2, and then in your exam you could be okay. So for example, the problem set 1, if you were like on average and you got around 70, and you got 70 again for the second problem set, and you only got 50% in the midterm, if you get around 75 in the exam, you can still get a very good grade. Right? So it doesn't mean things are uber now, so that happens to not at all. Right? If you're really concerned about your grade, then you can talk to me. Okay? I will also make announcements later today on Canvas, telling you which of us marked which question of the midterm. So as everything, if you have any concern about that question, you can ask a specific EA or you can ask me. Okay. So let's talk about the questions. So the first question relates to one-time pads, right? And then question 1 was actually very well answered. The average for this question was quite high, right? Very, very good performance. So the idea is that you're just going to do standard one-time pads. So we're telling you to use your student number to encrypt our message, and we've given you the table to basically convert between this message and your student number to binary value. Right? So everybody will have slightly different answer, but if I just took a student number of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the last 6 digits is 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, so I make that into binary value, and then basically I XOR it onto the ciphertext, and I will get a result. I think I made a copy and paste error in the people, but the top one is correct. So this is A5285B. So basically this is correct me. So you basically just make your own student number binary, you make the ciphertext or the plaintext binary, you XOR the two together to get your encrypted ciphertext. Okay? Then the next one, if you intercept a ciphertext of A5 to A5B, and you know the middle part of the plain text is D, and you don't know the first two characters, you don't know the last two characters, but you know the middle two characters, so how you modify the ciphertext is the known plain text part will decrypt to 77 instead of DB, 777 DB. So this is like that question we did in the tutorial 2, right? Remember that tutorial question where the guy tries to steal money because he knows the bank account number and he tries to change it to his own bank account number? So exactly the same principle, right? So you'll take the 2A, you'll convert it to binary, you'll take the DB, you convert it to binary, you XOR the two together to find the key stream, which is 93, and you XOR that 93 to your plain text that you want it to be, which is 77, and then you have a new ciphertext, which is A5E45B, which is the receiver that decrypts. The middle part will change from DB to 77. Okay. So just a note in general, not that I expected you to do it this way, but just in the future, after this course, if anyone, if somebody always asks me, like, okay, but how can I do binary? In practice, like, do really fast. Actually, like, even if you have a Windows calculator, if you set it to the programmer mode, it will do all of it for you. So you can enter hex numbers, you can enter binary numbers, you can enter the decimal number, and then basically just do all the binary functions, add or XOR. So if you ever have to calculate it really fast for something else, then you can always use the standard calculator. So question two, there were two modes of operation. The one is CFD, the other one is counter mode. And I give you the three equations for the encryption, and I ask you to give the decryption equation. Okay? So this question two was not that well answered, but I think it also had the most difficult question in the text. So the last two questions asking about the files and then that sensor data, those are challenging questions. So those are the ones that should be hard. Okay? So it's also to be expected. The standard stuff was reasonably well answered. So, counter mode, C0 is the encryption of IB XOR to P0, C1 is the encryption of IB plus 1 XOR to P1, and C2 is the encryption of IB plus 2 XOR to 2. So that means the plain text is the encryption of IB XOR to C0, P1 is the encryption of IB plus 1 XOR to C1, and P2 is the encryption of IB plus 2 XOR to C2. So this one is quite straightforward. For CFD mode, C0 is equal to the encryption of IB XOR to P0, C1 is the encryption of C0 XOR to P1, and C2 is the encryption of C1 XOR to P2. The biggest problem came here. So some people, instead of saying encrypt here, put decrypt here. So it's not a decrypt, right? For CVC mode, it's decryption, because you're actually decrypting something and then XORing it with the previous IB or the previous ciphertext one. For CFD mode, to have P0, it's the encryption of IB XOR to C0. P1 is the encryption of C0 XOR to C1. And P2 is the encryption of C1 XOR with C2. Okay. Right. So during the transmission, one bit of C0 is changed. So the one bit is changed, one block is lost, is sort of the standard question. Come up every time. Right? And which mode is the error propagation less? Briefly explain the error. So the error is worse for mode 1, because mode 1 has 2 block error and mode 2 only has 1 block error. So the 2 block error in mode 1, P0 is equal to C1 XOR to the encryption of ID. Ignore that. I'll do it over here. P0 is the encryption of IB XOR to C0, right? So if C0 is incorrect, then P0 is going to be incorrect. P1 is the encryption of C0 XOR to C1. So if C0 is incorrect, P1 will be correct. P2 P2 is C1 and C2, so that will incorrect C0, so P2 will be correct. Okay? And then similarly, for if you look at the counter mode, right, you'll see that every time it's only one block, right? Because none of the blocks involve a C0 from any previous transmission. So if C0 is wrong, E0 is going to be wrong. But then after that, P1 and P2 will be correct. Okay. I don't know why I get copied and pasting this thing. Okay, so during transmission, the entire block is lost. So which mode is better, right? So if we go back to the decryption operation, for this one, if C0, C1, and C2 instead become C1 and C2 and C3, right? Then we're going to have the missing block. Right, we're then going to have an incorrect block, and then we are going to have a correct block. So we're basically doing P0 is the encryption of ID, XOR to C1, which is going to be incorrect. Then we're going to do P1 is the encryption of C1, XOR to C2, which means P1 is actually P2, but it is still correct. Right? And then P3 would be C2 XOR to C3, which means the actual P3, but it's actually correct. So we'll lose a block, and then we will have one block incorrect, and then it will work. Right. For the second one, it is more complicated. If C0 disappears, and we have C1, C2, and C3, all of the messages are going to be incorrect forever. The reason is because P0 is the encryption of ID XOR to C1, but it should really be the encryption of ID plus 1, right? And then the next one we're going to say P1 is ID plus 1 XOR to C2, but that was encrypted with ID plus 2. Because we have this synchronized counter, and by losing that block, we have basically lost synchronization, right? So for the receiver, for the rest of the message, the offset of the counter is always going to be incorrect by 1. So in essence, 4 remaining blocks will be wrong. I will fix those 3 examples before I do it. Okay, you need to encrypt customer records that are then stored on a server. You regularly need to access and update these records. Which of these modes would be more efficient to use? Briefly explain why. It would definitely be mode 2, because in mode 2, if we want to decrypt, let's say, the first block of customer data, we just make the counter, we encrypt it, we XOR it to the record, we get the plaintext record, we can update the plaintext record and then re-encrypt it, and that has no impact on C1 and C2. Okay? For CFD mode, we can basically, let's say, we can encrypt ID, we can XOR it to our record C0, then we update the P0 and we re-encrypt the new C0, but now C1 is dependent on C0 and C2 is dependent on the new C1. So that means we have to decrypt and re-encrypt all the remaining blocks to make that update on that file. Right? And that was also in the slide. On the slide in the lecture notes where we discuss counter mode, it is also explicitly mentioned there. Okay. So for the last one, you build a system where there's a hardware device and it's used to collect sensor data in a factory. We're basically using the sensor data to control, so it's very time critical. So essentially, once we take the sensor reading, we have to upload it within 0.1 seconds. Okay? So we take a sensor reading every 1 second, and then we only have 1/10 of a second to upload it. So your device can do an XOR of 0.01 seconds, and a block cipher takes 0.065 seconds to encrypt one block. Can you use one of the modes of operation in 2A and explain your answer? So yes, you can use mode 2, and what you should have realized is, for mode 2, you have 1 second between readings. So actually the device can go, I know I'm making a reading 1 second from now, and I would need to encrypt it very fast and send, So the device can pre-compute encryption of IV, encryption of IV plus 1, and encryption of IV plus 2. Then the moment you take the reading, P0, P1, and P2, you can do the three XORs, and you can set, which means you are on time. For the mode on the left, you cannot do things early, and you cannot do things in parallel, right? Because to encrypt C1, we need C0. And to encrypt C2, we need C1. That means we have to get the readings, encrypt C0. Only once we have C0 can we encrypt C1. Only once we have C1, we can encrypt C2. That means we have to do everything after one another, right? And that will take too long a time, and we will miss our timing requirement. So the answer is mode 2. Okay, so for question 3, given E equals 13, Q equals 23, and E equals 19, write down the equation for signing message, show all your calculation, message 1, 2, 3, 4. So N is equal to P times Q is equal to 13 times 23 is equal to 299. Phi of N is equal to P minus 1 times Q minus 1, which is 264. V is then the modular inverse of E modulo phi n. So you do the extended Euclidean algorithm. 264 is equal to 13 times 19 plus 17. 19 is equal to 1 times 17 plus 2. 17 is equal to 1 times 2 plus 1. You work backwards. 1 is equal to 17 minus 8 times 2, which is equal to 17 minus 8 times 19 minus 1 times 17. Which is equal to 9 times 17 minus 8 times 19. 9 times 17 minus 8 times 19 is 9 times 264 minus 13 times 19 minus 8 times 19, which gives you 9 times 264 minus 125 times 17. So we apply modulo 296 to both sides, and we get 1 modulo 296 is congruent to minus 125 times 17 modulo 264. Can't have a modular inverse that's negative, so we make it the smallest positive value by plussing the modulus values with 1s, and we get E equal to 123. Right? And then the answer is just the signature is the message 1234 raised to the private exponent modulus N, which is 299. And that is all that was needed. Right? Just write down the equation for signing the message. Unfortunately, I think more than 80% of you try to solve this equation, right? Which you were not required to do. I did not expect you to do it. I just asked you to write down the equation. But I can understand how some people get a little bit confused, so that is why I made the adjustment. Because if you actually then started doing square and multiply to try and solve the equation, you could fail. Okay. But apart from this question was also very well answered. Question 3 was actually also very well answered, just like question 1. So that's good, because that means most people can do the number theory job. Right? Which is good. Okay, so for question B, you have an alpha-mile encryption system with public key Y, P equal to 11, and D equal 2. Calculate the private key X. So what you should realize is that Y is equal to G to the X mod P, and there's no real way to calculate it. Because P is only 11, the easiest way to do it is just to brute force search. So you have to try one of 10 numbers until you get one that works, right? And the answer is 7, right? So X is equal to 7, right? So you just have to go G to the Y mod P, G to the 2 mod P, G to the 3 mod P until you get one. Okay, so briefly explain the difficult problem you need to solve to do this. So this is the discrete logarithm problem. So if you have B, C, and D, it's easy to calculate A. But if you have A, B, and D, it's very difficult to calculate C. And then why you're able to solve this very difficult question or difficult problem is because the numbers are really small. So remember when we said when we worked with asymmetric cryptography, the strength is in the fact that the numbers are really big. If the numbers are small, we can solve the discrete logarithm problem quite easily. If the numbers are small, we can solve the factorization problem quite easily. Right. So basically, we need larger numbers for this to be secure. Okay, question 4. What mechanism can be used for non-repudiation? Explain why it provides non-repudiation. It's a digital digital signature provides no repudiation because only one person has the private key and can sign the list. Right? That's the reason. Okay. Would you be able to use one of the block cipher rows in question 2A to construct a MAC in a way similar to a CPC MAC? Briefly explain your answer. So this was also intended to be a very challenging problem for me, right? So the answer is actually no. Neither of the rows in 2A can be used to calculate a MAC. The reason for that is because both of them actually quite trivially allows for modification of the plaintext. Remember that when we do a MAC, we are sending the plaintext message together with the MAC, right? So we basically know what P0, P1, and P2 is when we are doing the MAC calculation, right? So let's say for mode 1, we chose C2 as our MAC tag. So our MAC tag is the encryption of C1, right, together with the XOR of P2, right? But we know P2. So we can XOR P2 to C2, and then XOR any new P onto it that we want to modify that last block of plaintext, right? And we can do exactly the same with counter mode, right? We know what C2 is, because C2 is our MAC tag. We know P0, P1, and P2. So once again, if we XOR P2 to C2, we will get this value, even though we don't have the key. And then we can XOR a new plaintext on it for any value that we want. Mode of operation 2 would generally be a bad one anyway, because there's no link between C2 and P1 and P0. Right? So the only one you could feasibly use in any case is the first one, which is similar to CPC mode, and then it's intended to be designed that every ciphertext depends on the previous plaintext, right? But it still has the same issue about the last block. You can basically change the last block very easily. So it's not a very good back function. Okay. Alice wants to send data to Bob and also provide data origin authentication of D. So that's going to be modified. Alice sends Bob only the message MAC CABM. Does this message achieve what Alice wanted to do? It does not, because it doesn't actually help Bob anything. Bob gets a MAC of the message, but there's no way, so the message would be D, right? The data D, but there's nothing that Bob can actually do to make it work. Right? Because Bob cannot take a MAC and extract the data from it. Right? He's going to get this MAC value and he's going to say, this is very nice, but I don't actually have the data and I have nothing to verify against this MAC. And I can also do nothing to this MAC to try and extract the original set data out of it. Right? If Alice sent D together with the MAC of D, right, then it would be fine. Then we would be okay. Right? But just sending Bob the MAC doesn't actually transfer any sort of data or message to Bob. Okay, then for the last questions, AES has 192-bit block size. AES has 128, 192, and 256-bit keys, but their block size are all the same. They're all 128-bit blocks. Perfect secrecy means that encryption method is secure because attackers cannot practically find the plaintext with the computing resources they have available today. This is false. What is being described here is computational secrecy. Remember, we talked about computational secrecy and perfect secrecy in two places. When we talked about OneHandPad and the very first lecture of the course, where we talked about why we want to use security and can security always be secure. Right? So, this is false because perfect secrecy says even if the attacker has infinite resources, the system should still be secure. Right, like one time pad. Even if the attacker has all the time and resources in the world, it will still secure the data. Asymmetric cryptography can be used to provide confidentiality, data origin, authentication, and non-repudiation. This is true. It can do encryption, it can do digital signature, and the digital signature can provide us both non-repudiation and integrity. Right, and then in Bitcoin, miners are essentially hashing the random number r until h of r is equal to a set number provided by the system. This is mostly closely related to breaking collision resistance of the hash function. This is false. There's already a given value, and the guy is trying to find a hash to match that given value. Remember, for collision, the guy has full control over both values. Okay? So this is either more related to one-wayness or second free image resistance. So if you mention either one of these, it would be okay. Right? So we are given h of x, and we need to find an x that gives us the same hash value, or another value that is going to give us the same hash value. And then the final one, this brute force search requires an average 2 to the 62 guesses. This is false, but this has a 50, and the effort to estimate is 2 to the n minus 1, which is 2. Okay, so I will fix the one of the small issues I figured out while I was posting the solution, and I will post the solution for you on Canvas. So you can check it there, you can compare it against your midterm, and if there's anything wrong with your midterm and of marking, or if there's like a simple thing wrong, like some marks missing, you have exactly the answer in the solution, but your mark is missing, then you can talk to the TA that marked that question. I will put that on Canvas. If it's more complicated question, like you answered something and it's not the answer in the solution, but you also think it should be correct, then you're more welcome to talk to me. Then you can think about it. See if it's also a good solution. So that is everything for the midterm. I think I just want to take a short, like a few minutes break, because then you can just think about the midterm for 1 or 2 seconds. Because I just have to move the lecture slides to this, because we are trying to do the recording for the lecture again, and it requires me to work from this. I did not want to record the solution to the lecture, but for the rest of the lecture, I'm trying to make sure the recording of the lecture, but I have to find the end of the lecture and then get it started. So if you just give me 2 or 3 minutes,